This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with the great investigative reporter, Lisa Graves. She has, for the last 10 years, been looking into the influence of dark money on recruiting and placing ultra-right-wing lawyers on our federal benches, Amy Comey Barrett being the latest.
Recently, New York University held a webinar on censorship by social media platforms.
And then it was censored by Zoom. What an irony, a private company censoring a university program on censorship.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Despite the clear language of our Constitution that Congress shall have no religious test for the office of judge, last week, every Republican in the Senate except one put Amy Comey Barrett on an already packed right-wing Supreme Court. Barrett is a leader of the charismatic Christian cult called People of Promise. It's a group that Protestant and Catholic evangelicals formed, and they reportedly speak in tongues. They believe in the subjugation of women. They oppose their right to choose and control their own bodies. They oppose gay marriage and are authoritarian and pro-corporate in the extreme. Garrett earned her bones by first clerking for the now-dead Justice Antonin Scalia. She was part of the legal team, along with John Roberts, who helped Republican George W. Bush steal the presidency by stopping the recount of ballots in Florida in the year 2000. The Federalist Society, led by Leonard Leo, has been responsible for packing the federal courts with over 200 largely unqualified young ideologues who will serve for life. Leo, like the 6 of 9 Supreme Court justices, is an ultra-right-wing Catholic. For 20 years, he has guided the Federalist Society. He is a member of Opus Dei, Latin for God's work. It was founded in 1928 by a Spanish priest who was also a lawyer and a supporter of the Spanish fascist dictator Francisco Franco. Ultra-right-wing billionaire Charles Koch and the Bradley Foundation have contributed to the efforts of the Federalist Society. Dark money is behind the appointments of now over 200 judges in the federal judiciary. Organizations funded by dark money fund and encourage plaintiffs to bring cases challenging laws they don't like and write the briefs to submit to the judges they help put on the bench. We speak today with attorney Lisa Graves. She created True North Research and is its executive director and editor-in-chief. Her research and analysis has been cited by every major newspaper in the country. Attorney Graves has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the government. She served as chief counsel for the nominations for the U.S. Judiciary Committee under Senator Patrick Leahy. She was a career deputy assistant attorney general at the U.S. Department of Justice. Graves has spent the past 10 years investigating the impact of dark money on the judicial selection. Lisa Graves, a real pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's a joy to be on with you.
Lisa, 2 weeks ago at the Amy Comey Barrett confirmation hearings in the Senate, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island called the hearings, quote, a puppet show. He said the strings were being pulled by dark money, that the objective was to remake the national judiciary, diminish the civil jury, weaken the regulatory agencies which protect the public trust, allow unlimited money in politics, and restrict voting rights. Please talk about his testimony. Talk about dark money. What is it and who has it?
Well, I think what Senator Whitehouse did this past month in describing what's happening to our Supreme Court and the dark money swirling around it is of vital public importance. And that's because what we have here is a situation where a very powerful man named Leonard Leo, who is the co-chair of the Federalist Society, which describes itself as a group of conservative and libertarian lawyers and law students, actually has been playing a key role in packing U.S. courts, federal courts, the Supreme Court, and other courts. Leonard Leo is the person who chooses the judges that Trump chooses from, and he's choosing people to advance an agenda that he himself described at a closed-door meeting that the Washington Post revealed last year At that closed-door meeting to funders, Leonard Leo said that America stands at the precipice, at the edge of what he described as the revival of what he called the structural constitution, the likes of which no one had seen since before the New Deal. And he basically described how no one in that room that he was speaking to was alive to see the kind of legal revolution that was underway due to these appointments. That effort to basically roll back a century of law that the right wing in this country dislikes is an unprecedented sort of extreme effort to re-engineer America in their own image. And they're doing it with dark money. Dark money in the electoral context is money that is not disclosed because it's not given directly to a candidate. It's money that is spent to help that candidate win. And the Supreme Court under Roberts has already begun that structural revolution that Leonard spoke of. And that's because in the Citizens United decision, it said that Congress could not regulate and limit that outside spending by those groups if they didn't, you know, go directly to the candidate call for that candidate's election. It said in the Shelby County case on voting rights that basically the Voting Rights Act of 1965 could be gutted based on that narrow majority on that court. And also it said in the recent redistricting cases that other courts could not intervene even where there was gross, extreme partisan redistricting that was denying fair representation to Americans in terms of who represents them in Congress. And so this revolution is underway, and we don't know who the major funders are. We know they're people who can write million-dollar checks to influence who gets on the U.S. Supreme Court and help push them through despite their controversy. We do know Charles Koch, who's one of the richest billionaires, in the whole wide world, is very invested in trying to capture our courts to accomplish his extreme agenda. But we don't know who all the funders are who are having such a disproportionate impact on who gets chosen for the court and how they get pushed through. We also know, as Senator Whitehouse pointed out, that many of the groups that are getting money from those same interests are also bringing cases to the Supreme Court to get those decisions that they dislike overturned.
Lisa, now that Barrett is on the Supreme Court, the reactionaries have a majority. How will this affect upcoming cases like the legality of Obamacare, gay marriage, and the right of a woman to control her own body?
Well, I think those cases are in grave jeopardy, and that's because Leonard Leo was choosing judges to meet the litmus test that the president, President Trump, and his party have said that they're going to impose on this court, and that includes trying to choose judges who are going to overturn the Affordable Care Act, who are going to overturn Roe versus Wade. That's their agenda. It's explicit. We know that gay rights are also at stake or at issue here. That's because this reactionary majority that's been chosen has hostility to the rights of LGBTQ Americans. And we know from a decision just this past week where Justice Thomas and Justice Alito issued an opinion basically in the case involving the clerk that refused to issue the marriage license, that they're trying to use freedom of worship not as a shield, but as a sword to strike down the rights of other Americans, and in particular, the rights of LGBTQ Americans. But also, we know that this president has said that he wants and he wanted Justice Barrett on the court. He wanted her on the court because he wants her vote in election cases that are going to be coming to the court that are on their way right now, in which he's going to be trying to stop votes from being counted by Americans in order to win this election by judicial fiat. And so a huge number of rights are at risk, but also other rights as those that were alluded to in the Leonard Leo speech about this legal revolution to roll back a whole century of precedents around the laws that were passed in the New Deal.
I'm thinking about the Janus case, and before that, Citizens United, and the Shelby County case that you mentioned. Might you please speak about these?
Yes, it's certainly the case that the right wing in this country has targeted labor rights, has targeted a number of statutes and judicial decisions to try to reverse the rights of Americans to organize and to negotiate all the terms of their working conditions with powerful corporations. What you have in many ways in these past several years is the a sort of supremacy of corporate rights over individual rights. You can see that in the Hobby Lobby case. In that case, there was a retailer, a craft store, that claimed that the company had religious beliefs that would bar it from allowing its employees, the clerks, the women who work for those at that retailer, from having access to IUDs, which is a common birth control device. And so that company's corporate sort of, quote, religious beliefs were elevated over the actual rights of human beings, the women who work there, and their rights to access affordable health care, including birth control. Meanwhile, after that decision was issued, that company was found to have stolen 11,000 artifacts from the Middle East. And so apparently the thou shalt not steal religious dictate didn't apply to them, but they were going to impose this view by a corporation about women's access to birth control as a religious belief.
Lisa, tell us more about Leonard Leo, Federalist Society leader. The society is responsible for selecting judges that the Republican Senate goes on to confirm. Over 200 federal judges have recently been put in place in the lower appellate and Supreme Court, as we've seen. Tell us a bit more about Leo's agenda and his connections to the reactionary right wing.
Yes, you know, it is the case that the Federal Society has been given a privileged role in judicial selection in Republican administrations, and no more privileged role than this current one, where Leonard Leo, who is now the co-chair of the Federal Society and previously its executive vice president, where he has been tasked with by Trump with actually choosing the slate of judges that he picks from for the U.S. Supreme Court, for the highest court in the land. But we also know that almost all of the appellate judges, meaning the circuit court judges who sit between the trial court judges and the Supreme Court, most of those, if not all of them that Trump has picked, are from the Federal Society, are members or active participants in Federal Society events. And that society, you know, really is funded by unknown sources. Its biggest known donor is Donors Trust and Donors Capital, which are two funds that hide their donors. Another big donor is a big right-wing foundation. And of course, Charles Koch is a major multi-million dollar donor over the years to the Federal Society. But Leonard Leo himself is someone who went to Cornell Law School. He ended up going to work for the Federal Society basically very early in his career, having joined it initially. And he has gotten very rich, it appears, from his work on judicial nominations. And I say that because he's claimed that he has been a volunteer for the president, so he doesn't fill out any financial disclosure forms that an employee of the federal government who's tasked with helping to choose judges would fill out. And I myself was at the Justice Department working on judicial nominations, and I know that all the lawyers in the White House counsel's office and the Justice Department who work on nominations go through a background check and have financial checks. But Leonard Leo, as a quote volunteer, does not reveal the sources of his income or his growth in assets. And we know that in 2018, the year that he was working to get Brett Kavanaugh installed on the court, he took basically a $100,000 pay cut from the Federal Society, but he paid off the mortgage on his home. A 30-year mortgage he paid off about 22 years early. And on the eve of the vote on Kavanaugh, the day that the Senate voted on cloture to move forward with his nomination, Leonard Leo closed on a $3.3 million mansion in Maine. So he has enriched himself while he's been playing this role, and no one knows who's making him richer because those sources are hidden from the American people. They're not required to be disclosed under current law. Subsequently, this year, he left his paid position at the Federal Society to be the co-chair of it overall and created, with some of these colleagues who've been working on these dark money groups with him, a new group, a for-profit group, to advance this agenda.
Lisa, do you want to say anything more about the Federalist Society and their agenda and who funds it, or have we covered that sufficiently?
Well, I would say that it's quite clear that the Federal Society is funded by major corporations. A lot of the lawyers who are part of it work at law firms in defense of huge corporations. A number of the attorneys that are part of it are part of the GOP's efforts on election law, including a number of these lawsuits to make it harder for Americans to vote and to try to limit the ability of Americans to vote during this pandemic in terms of extensions that some states have tried to provide so people can vote. a lot of lawyers who work for huge corporations, as well as one of the biggest corporations on the planet, which is Koch Industries, which is led by Charles Koch. And its agenda really has been to change American law and change it in ways that advance those corporate interests. And in my view, really limit the rights of ordinary Americans. And in terms of Leonard Leo's role, it has also included this attack on core rights of women in this country, reproductive rights, as well as equality rights. And so I think that Leonard Leo's role in the judicial appointment process is very troubling, especially because he appears to have gotten very rich while doing this.
Lisa, you mentioned Charles Koch. Please talk about the efforts of his group, Americans for Prosperity.
Sure. Well, Americans for Prosperity is the political arm of Charles Koch. And Charles Koch has operated under a number of groups that have changed their names over the years. But recently, there was a memo that went out to his billionaire funders, his allies, in these efforts in which he talked expressly about working with the Federal Society on judicial nominations and on other issues. And just to be clear, I'm not suggesting that Leonard Leo is engaged in illegal activity. I think there are substantial gaps in the law that have been exploited that have allowed this person to play such a decisive role without having any meaningful disclosure to the American people. But Charles Koch is one of the main proponents of that attack on our election laws, on anti-corruption laws. And in fact, earlier this year, I documented how his money helped subsidize the original decision in Buckley versus Vallejo in terms of the litigation in that case back in 1976, which is the root of the Citizens United decision and this effort to limit our ability to take action to limit the influence of dark money forces like Charles Koch, basically, on our elections. But the agenda of AFP is quite broad and I think has been very damaging for America. For example, it was Americans for Prosperity in its predecessor name, Citizens for a Sound Economy, that really first pushed forward in a big way the effort to repeal Glass-Steagall, which was the protection that was passed after the Great Depression, after the meltdown of Wall Street back in 1929, to prevent banks from engaging in this kind of gambling that wrecked our economy in 2008. It was American Prosperity that really, in its predecessor form, Citizens for a Sound Economy, that helped work on efforts to attack Kyoto and the initial efforts 30 years ago to try to stem the tide of climate change that was underway. It played a key role in trying to push forward this narrative of denial and uncertainty around climate change. It has engaged in an array of activity to make it harder to regulate corporations like Koch Industries and pollution, but it also partnered with the tobacco industry on trying to limit the impact or the reach of regulations around tobacco, which causes cancer and kills people. Its record is one of trying to take away from the federal government's power of taxation and state governments as well to tax in order to have a government that functions well for the American people. And so in the states, it plays a very heavy political role through its C4 operation in the states and elections. And in fact, even though Charles Koch has attempted to distance himself from Trump, the man, Charles Koch and his operations have worked quite well and closely with Trump, the administration, to dismantle regulations that protect Americans' rights to cleaner air and cleaner water, as well as the Consumer Financial Protection Board, as well as this ongoing effort to attack and erode the Affordable Care Act. But not just that. Back in 2016, Americans for Prosperity played a key role in swing states in moving voters out and toward Trump in terms of buoying Trump's efforts in 2016, even though Charles Koch himself did not endorse Trump.
We're speaking with Lisa Graves, the great investigator. Lisa, this information is really quite extraordinary. Both of us are from Wisconsin, and as a consequence, I've always taken an interest in the Bradley Foundation, which is centered in Wisconsin. Can you talk about the Bradley Foundation and the role that it plays?
The Bradley Foundation is a fascinating case study in one of the things that has happened with wealth and influence in America. This is a foundation that was created from the wealth of two brothers who had an industrial, you know, endeavor, you know, series of factories in essence in Milwaukee, and that got very, very rich. They were extremely hostile to labor rights and to, you know, progressive ideas in America. And they created a foundation back more than 50 years ago to put their wealth into this sort of tax-protected philanthropy, or put a portion of their wealth in it. It now has more than $750 million in assets. So it's nearly a $1 billion enterprise. And while they are long gone and their family members are no longer on the board of the Bradley Foundation is led by two other billionaires, by Art Pope, who has worked long with Charles Koch and David Koch previously at Americans for Prosperity in advancing that agenda, and Diane Hendricks, who's one of the biggest donors to the Republican Party alongside Art Pope here in Wisconsin. And they help steer the money of that foundation to advance this right-wing agenda in America to really remake the United States. That includes efforts to push these charter schools and efforts that take money out of public schools and put it into basically private hands, which is a longstanding part of the right-wing effort of Charles Koch and Milton Friedman to limit public schools, to take away the idea of public schools and put more of that money into private hands and private education, education that may not actually include information that people need to know to be really well-informed citizens, but rather push a particularly narrow ideological agenda. But the Bradley Foundation has also played a role behind the scenes, as Senator Whitehouse spoke about this past month, which is that they've been funding amicus briefs, which are briefs, so-called friend of the court briefs, that are written to the U.S. Supreme Court to try to influence them on rulings. And that includes on cases involving the Affordable Care Act and also on labor cases. So the predecessor to the Janus case you mentioned is a case that this foundation was funding through a group called the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which also is funded by Charles Koch, to attack both labor rights and Americans' rights to access affordable health care. And so it plays, I think, a very significant role in funding the right-wing infrastructure.
Lisa, in January of this year, Leonard Leo started a new group called CRC Advisors. What do you know about it?
Well, we know that it is this group is tied to one of his best friends, in essence, this guy named Greg Mueller, who was running CRC, which was previously known as Creative Response Concepts. That's an advertising media firm that, you know, has been active in a lot of campaigns, including getting money from Charles Koch's groups like Americans for Prosperity to advance its agenda. This group is working with a number of other sort of shell groups or front groups that are tied to some of the same individuals that have been working with Leo on this court capture. And that includes Neil Corkery and Ann Corkery, who were previously the leaders of the Wellspring Committee. Wellspring Committee was a group that was basically a pass-through for the money of some of these big donors in order to influence policy and courts in this country. It would receive, for instance, a check from an unknown source for like $24 million, and then give almost all that money to another group tied to Leonard Leo called the Judicial Crisis Network, which is the group that was has been most active in advertising for these Trump judicial appointees to the Supreme Court. But it's also tied to other for-profit and nonprofit groups that are also tied to Leonard Leo, that Leonard Leo has a ownership interest in. And so it's quite the nest of, or what I think of as almost like a shell game, of LLCs and nonprofits that are all working to influence who gets on our courts for lifetime positions, and who is really funding them is kept hidden from the American people.
To stop the right-wing majority from trampling on our rights, some people have proposed that the Supreme Court needs to be unpacked and that America needs a modern judiciary that reflects our diversity. Others, like the late historian Howard Zinn, have argued that massive political pressure, like demonstrations in the streets, civil disobedience, strikes, is what has historically preserved our liberties. Your thoughts on that, please, Lisa.
Well, I think that there are, I think that they're not an either or, but perhaps a both and I would also add voting to that. I think that there are a number of ways that we can secure our rights. That includes certainly voting and making sure people are voting, have the right to vote and have that right honored and have your votes be counted. I think that there's no doubt that peaceful protest has played a substantial role in progress in America and the civil rights movement and more. And there's always been some repression of those peaceful movements in this country's history, unfortunately. But people power, people in this era of COVID being safely protesting, you know, with masks, with social distancing is important. Unfortunately, some the police have frequently fired tear gas into crowds during this pandemic, which is, I think, actually quite irresponsible on a number of counts, including the fact that this is a disease that is transmitted by breathing and coughing. Certainly the power of people to stand up, use their feet to demand change, and that's a powerful force. And also, I think legislation can change and secure people's rights. And so I think it's important to explore all options to unpack the courts that have been packed. And in fact, now, if you look at the United States Supreme Court in my lifetime, in the last 50-some years since 1969, 16 of the justices confirmed to the United States Supreme Court were appointed by Republican presidents. Only 4 of the justices that have been appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court during the past 50 years have been from Democratic presidents. Now, 2 of those appointees and appointments were basically stolen from the Democrats, and that's the appointment that was Judge Merrick Garland was nominated for by President Obama in 2016 that Mitch McConnell blocked and that President Trump filled. That's one seat. And this seat right now that came open due to the unfortunate death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg just over a month ago, in which this nominee of President Trump, Amy Coney Barrett, has been forced through the United States Senate in about a month's time on the eve of an election, a very irregular, you know, basically non-repeating occurrence in American history where it has been generally the practice that someone is not confirmed this close to an election because the people are voting on the direction of our nation. And so 2 of those seats, in essence, in recent history were stolen. I think people have made other arguments about, you know, what happened with Bush v. Gore in the 2000 election, incumbent running in 2004, leading to John Roberts and Justice Alito being confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. But at least in the near term, had this not happened, had these 2 seats not been stolen, we would not have a 6-3 court with a majority of Republican appointees. We would have a 5-4 court with a majority of Democratic appointees.
There are some 260 million Christians in America. A quarter of them are evangelicals. It is clear that the evangelicals prevailed upon Trump to nominate Barrett. Constitutional attorney Michael Ripps, in his forthcoming book, Objection, argues that because the Constitution clearly states that no religious test can be used to appoint a judge, and that because the evangelical Christian lobby got Trump to nominate Barrett, that therefore an injunction could be gotten to prevent her from taking her seat or to remove her. What do you think about that argument?
Well, I haven't had a chance to fully review it. I do think that it's obviously quite clear in the United States Constitution that there can be no religious oath or test for office. So I'm not sure about the standing of a suit like that or how a claim like that would proceed. But I do think it is, you know, we're in a situation in which there has been, in essence, a quite explicit embrace of this nominee by her proponents based in part on her religion. But any attempt to discuss that has been attacked as being bigoted against her religion. And so, in essence, the proponents are talking quite a bit about her faith and why that's relevant to her nomination. But people who are concerned about her, if they raise the issue of her faith, have been called bigots. And so, you know, this situation is, you know, really an extraordinary situation that we face. I do know that there are progressive evangelicals who oppose, who have opposed her nomination and who have also opposed this pressure by some on the far right to try to claim that climate change isn't happening, or maybe if it is, that it's supposedly good on some theological level. But the fact is that we have groups, special interest groups, some of which are very express in their religious objectives of changing U.S. law to suit their own religious beliefs. That, I think, is the real challenge here, the real problem, which is that we need to have judges who are not going to be imposing their religious beliefs in a sort of theocratic way through rereading our Constitution. We need to have our constitutional rights protected without regard to our religion, without regard to whether we agree with one particular religious group's view of women's rights or gay rights. Our rights should not depend on the religious beliefs of a particular justice. So I think that's really the starting point, which is that we in America are not in a theocracy. We're in a country in which the Constitution expressly forbids that sort of religious test or religious oath. And even though Justice Scalia attempted to claim that his philosophy, this so-called originalism or constitutionalism, as they've tried to rebrand it for Amy Barrett, is neutral, it somehow was miraculously aligned with all of his personal beliefs, but for maybe two cases where he ostentatiously talked about how, you know, a particular case involving free speech wasn't in line with his personal views, you know, like naked dancing or something. But in general, on those issues of equality and human rights, his so-called judicial philosophy really served his personal agenda, his personal religious belief. And I think that that neutrality is not an accurate description. It's not been a neutral philosophy. It's one that has served an agenda that has been determined to try to overturn Roe versus Wade and to oppose the rights of gay Americans in our country.
Nancy McLean and Jane Mayer have written about the influence of dark money on the selection of state legislatures and governors and judges, and in drafting and promoting laws that favor the rich. They demonstrate that this has been part of a many decades project. Your thoughts about that, please.
Well, I think Nancy's precisely right on that point. And her book, Democracy in Chains, is really an important read. What she described is how this notion of what I call free market fundamentalism has really taken hold within the current Republican Party, which has been in many ways taken over by the sort of Koch libertarian theories. What that means is when you see these groups, they'll say things like, with respect to Amy Coney Barrett or the Federal Society, that they favor limited constitutional government. In terms of other groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council or Americans for Prosperity, these other two Koch-funded groups, they call it limited government. And that's really a clever way of saying limited democracy. Limited democracy is their objective, which is why Nancy's book, Democracy in Chains, is such an accurate description of what they have been doing in the United States and abroad. And that's this effort to basically enshrine this sort of free market notion that the free market knows best and that government should not be engaged in the public good, that we shouldn't have things like Social Security, we shouldn't have public schools, we shouldn't have the public really do anything besides protect property. That's a very radical reactionary view of government. And it really stems from one of the key influencers on Charles Koch's life, which was this guy named Bob Lefevre, who ran a thing called the Freedom School that was described as a, quote, anarcho-capitalist school. It was basically just a school in outside of Colorado Springs where millionaires and right-wingers would come to learn about this philosophy. Bob Lefevre refused to call himself an anarchist. He described himself as an autarchist as a way to around that term. But in essence, the idea was that government really has no place in society, in what they view as in everything it does impinging the rights of corporations and individuals, except for the protection of private property through police. That is just a view of America that is not consistent with our actual Constitution, with our founding principles, and with modern interpretations of our rights through the Civil Rights Act and others that sought to give meaning and effect to principles in our Constitution like equal protection of the law. And so we certainly have a right to have laws that protect against discrimination under the 14th Amendment. We certainly have a right to have laws that Congress can pass and that agencies can promulgate through regulation to protect our rights to clean air and clean water, our rights as citizens to regulate that through our legislature. But instead, you have this deep antipathy by Charles Koch, which he was someone who took that Powell memo, that the famous Powell memo from 1971 that was written to the Chamber of Commerce that claimed that businesses had too little influence in American law, that corporations had too little influence in America because we had an Earth Day and we finally had a Clean Water Act to deal with, you know, rivers that were on fire and to deal with this massive pollution by the carbon industry and other industries that was really affecting our waterways and our lungs and our lives. Those corporations have deep hostility to government regulation, to us using our elected representatives, our legislatures, to enact laws to protect our interests, which Congress certainly has the right to do in these areas involving energy, involving our environment, involving our schools, to have a modern America that gives people a chance to, you know, really be free in that genuine sense, not be free of any government regulation, but to have a society that works, that functions, where we have public roads versus these private tollways that enrich the few. And we have government prisons that need to be reformed and improved versus for-profit prisons, where we have public schools that are well-funded and that provide equal opportunities for all kids and not a series of sort of balkanized private schools where kids aren't actually learning about science and the scientific method, which is, you know, sort of a key component of the idea of America in terms of the ideas of the Enlightenment. So there is a regressive force in America that has taken hold of that Republican Party, and a variant of that regressive force is embodied in this president. We are at a crossroads about the direction we're going to take for the 21st century, whether we're going to roll back the clock, as Leonard Leo has said the court is about to the robber baron era before the New Deal, or whether we're going to chart a new course and insist that America can and must do better for the rights and opportunities of people in America by ensuring that we have government that works well for the people.
Lisa Graves, we're unfortunately coming to an end of our allotted time. I just want to say personally that it's just a joy to speak with you. Both of us are products of the state of Wisconsin, the great state of Wisconsin, and the educational system that we went through there, which posited the idea that government and universities should work for the public good. With that in mind, I wanted to ask you what you're working on now, and how can our listeners keep in touch with you and keep in touch with your work?
Oh, well, thank you so much, Michael. I am a proud graduate of the University of Wisconsin at La Crosse. I believe it's vitally important that Americans have access to quality education that is affordable if it's not free. And in fact, shockingly, Charles Koch actually worked on a project to say that, you know, the problem with public universities in the 1970s was that they cost too little. So we have a big fight on our hands, and you can find my work that details all of that research on my site, TrueNorthResearch.org, and I've got a project called CokeDocs.org. So people can find me at TrueNorthResearch.org and CokeDocs, that's D-O-C-S, CokeDocs.org. And I'm happy to come on anytime and talk with you and Heidi. It's a joy to be on your show.
Thank you so much, Lisa Graves.
TrueNorthResearch.org.
Keep up the good work, and we hope to have you back on very soon. You take it easy, Lisa.
Thank you. Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Big technology companies, rather than leaders of academic institutions, it seems, are fast becoming an arbiter of academic speech. 2 weeks ago, Zoom shut down a New York University-organized webinar. Ironically, it was on the issue of censorship by tech platforms. The webinar was going to take up the censorship of an earlier open classroom session at San Francisco State University, featuring Palestinian rights advocate Leila Khaled. It was part of a so-called day of action against the criminalization and censorship of campus political speech. Canceling a campus event violates the principles of academic freedom that universities must observe. Allowing Zoom to override this bedrock principle at the behest of organized, politically motivated groups is a grave error for any university administration to make, and it should not escape censure from faculty. Joining us today is the former vice president of the American Association of University Professors and longtime chair of its Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. Henry Reichman is especially qualified to discuss the issue. Professor Emeritus of History at California State University at East Bay, Professor Reichman devotes nearly 300 pages in his most recent book by Johns Hopkins University Press, The Future of Academic Freedom. Professor Reichman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Professor, what reason did Zoom give for canceling the October NYU webinar on censorship?
Well, I'm not quite sure. The original cancellation that they did was at San Francisco State, where the reason was the presence on the panel of a woman who had been convicted of a terrorist act, but has since been freed and pardoned. I think it was a prisoner exchange or something. And they were under pressure from pro-Israeli groups who didn't want her to be allowed to speak. I don't know whether she was actually in attendance or speaking on the NYU panel, or if just the fact of the subject matter was what caused them to cancel it.
What do you think the real reasons were?
They were under pressure. They feared, I assume, that there would be legal consequences if on one of their, something they were sponsoring, there was agitation in support of terrorism against the law. I mean, that's fundamentally wrong. For one thing, it violates First Amendment notions of freedom of speech, but of course they're not a government entity. And this is the real problem with outsourcing education to a private interest, although NYU, of course, is a private institution, but San Francisco State was a public institution. And outsourcing this to Zoom and giving them the right to be able to say, well, we will determine when a program violates or potentially violates the law and we will cancel it, rather than the university being able to decide things through their usual procedures, honoring free speech and academic freedom.
Back to the NYU administration, they claim they knew nothing about Zoom's decision and have said they've raised the issue with Zoom representatives. Do you believe anything is going to come of that?
Well, I don't know. I think there should be pressure on Zoom. The real responsibility is with the universities, and I think that this incident is not the only one. There are real issues about Zoom and as well as other potential private hosts which have servers in China. There are other issues. I just received, for example, this morning, an email that went to faculty at the university where I'm retired now, but where I used to teach, calling on the faculty, telling the faculty that by a decision of the California State University General Counsel's office, all recorded Zoom sessions will be preserved for some undisclosed legal reason. I'm trying to find out what it is. But right away, that says to me that, you know, we're recording classes and keeping them, and who's going to then have access to that, and what basis? So I think this raises some much bigger questions for universities than just simply Zoom's desire as a business, which perhaps you might understand, to not get into controversy, which is, well, one level you want to say too bad. You know, you help universities. Universities are about controversy.
The mission statement of the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, begins this way: to advance academic freedom and shared governance. In your book, The Future of Academic Freedom, you assert that it's essential to fulfilling the mission of higher education to promote intellectual inquiry and knowledge. How do you explain this to individuals and those who think that it's an elitist privilege to go to a university?
Well, I think that Academic freedom stems from two related and sometimes goals that are sometimes to be in tension with each other. On the one hand, academic freedom is not about free speech. Free speech is, you know, I can get up on a street corner or write an op-ed saying any stupid thing I want, assuming it's not, you know, totally illegal, like, you know, a call to arms or something like that. But in a classroom, I'm not free to do that. I have to teach the course I'm being asked to teach, and I have to teach in accordance with the standards of my discipline and training. And if I don't do that, I'm not entitled to the academic freedom to do that. So in other words, what academic freedom is, on the one hand, is a professional right of the professoriate to be able to police itself in the same way that the medical profession polices itself in accordance with disciplinary standards. But why should other people, and the question you ask implies this, why should other people promote that? Why should we want that? Well, because the reason is that universities exist not simply for the personal advancement of students or individuals, but for the common good of society. The research and teaching missions of universities, private and public, if they don't serve the common good, then what is the point of having a university, and particularly, of course, a public university? And so I think that academic freedom is there because an independent professoriate is necessary not just to protect that professoriate as a privileged elite, but to protect the university's mission to serve the common good and ultimately to advance and promote democracy.
Professor, I like the example that you've cited before to illustrate this point of an engineering professor as a citizen advocating, for example, Holocaust denial without fear of institutional reprisal. But if a historian of 20th century Europe, for example, advocated for the same thing, that reflects on the professor's fitness.
Exactly, exactly. And academic freedom protects freedom of teaching and freedom of research, but it also, and this has probably been always the most controversial element of it, it protects faculty members' rights to speak as citizens, both as citizens of their institutions, where they might criticize the administration, and more importantly, of course, citizens of the broader society. Well, there's always been a controversy of, do we protect professors' rights as citizens to speak only in their area of expertise, or do we protect them in all areas? And the AUP has held for many, many years that we protect them in all areas. And so the example there is, of course, there's actually a person involved here, Arthur Butz, who was an electrical engineering professor at Northwestern University, who shortly after he gained tenure in electrical engineering, published a book about Holocaust denial, which is became one of the most prominent Holocaust deniers in the country. It's terribly embarrassing for the university, for Northwestern University, and some people may fear that maybe Jewish students might feel, you know, uncomfortable in his classes, but there's no evidence that he has ever brought those ideas into his engineering class. And of course, those ideas reflect nothing on his ability to be perhaps a brilliant engineer. We don't know. But of course, as you pointed out, that if I, as an historian of late modern Europe, which I am, were to begin teaching that or to write a book even about Holocaust denial in that perspective, well, I don't think my academic freedom would protect that because it's part of my it's in my discipline. The irony there, of course, is that, as one person put it, the less you know about something, the more rights you have as a professor to speak about it as a citizen. But that's, I think, the price we pay to protect people, because most professors, you know, we want professors to not just be narrow specialists who only write on some narrow area. We want them to be able to be rich thinkers. And so when we have a physicist, for example, who may be talking about the politics of science and make some uninformed statements about politics, we don't want that person, that brilliant physicist, to be punished.
Professor, I went to the University of Wisconsin, and there was a famous academic freedom fight there way back in 1894 when an economics and history professor named Richard Ely said something favorable in support of unions, and he was accused of being a socialist, which he was. And the question was put to the Board of Regents, which had a trial. The president of the university
wrote a famous statement, and I'd like to read it because I want your comments on it. The president wrote, and this is a plaque that's up on the main building on campus, and what it says is, "Whatever may be the limitations which trammel inquiry elsewhere, we believe that the great state University of Wisconsin should ever encourage that continual and fearless sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth can be found."
Well, what you've just referred to is, of course, one of the seminal cases that ultimately led about 20 years later to the formation of the AAUP. And the statement that you just read, I think, resonates perfectly today. If we cannot have a free inquiry in universities, where in society can we have them?
What's the value of free inquiry? We know what it is.
Well, I think the value of free inquiry, again, is this question of the common good, is that how are we to improve society, both materially in the ways that universities contribute through the sciences and other things, but culturally, spiritually, intellectually, et cetera, how are we to improve the common good of society and advance democracy and make the things that universities produce ever more available to more and more people if there isn't free inquiry? You know, if people aren't free to investigate and to go down roads that are sometimes unpopular or may challenge vested interests someplace. And that's the whole purpose of academic freedom. It's always an aspiration. I mean, that slogan at the University of Wisconsin, it's wonderful that they blazoned it upon a building. But, of course, the University of Wisconsin, like every other college and university in the United States, has had its moments to be proud of with respect to academic freedom and some moments to be not so proud of. But it's an aspiration that I think that we really have to constantly defend and contest.
Professor, turning just for a moment to social media, you have said that, quote, "it is the responsibility of college and university administrations to forcefully defend the right of their faculty members to tweet without fear of disciplinary consequences." Is that aspirational given the current, what I would call, punitive climate? And a public that seems so easily to be offended by tweets?
Well, I think that faculty members' expression as citizens should be just as well protected in electronic media as they were in traditional media. The difference, of course, is that when a faculty member writes a controversial op-ed piece or says something in an interview that's quoted somewhere that's a little bit controversial, it may reach several hundred, maybe several thousand people. On social media, it could reach tens, hundreds of thousands, even millions of people, and sometimes in a distorted form. And so, but the same principle should apply. And universities need to understand that when faculty members say something on Twitter or anything else, they speak for themselves. They don't speak for the university. The university simply has the obligation to say, look, this faculty member is speaking for him or herself. The university will have no more comment about it. We support their right to do that. That's the simple position. But unfortunately, too many universities feel they have to immediately say, well, we don't agree. Well, of course they don't agree. They don't have to agree. But it should be out there. Now, having said all that, I wrote a chapter of my book with a title called Can I Tweet That? Meaning implied, do I have the right to tweet that? And of course, my argument, as I just posted, is yes, you do. But there's also the question, should I tweet that? And of course, in today's atmosphere, anyone who's going to say something controversial in a medium like Twitter needs to steel him or herself against the possibility that they will be the victim of a Twitter mob of some kind of, and these are not just spontaneous things that the public responds to, but they're often, you know, things that are promoted by well-paid groups.
What do you think the AAUP chapter at NYU is going to do about the cancellation?
Well, they issued a very good statement. I know that we've had we are probably going to put out, as soon as I get off the phone, I'll probably be writing it, a national statement in support of them. We'll be urging the administration to basically say to Zoom that this is not acceptable. But as I suggested before, I think the problem, unfortunately, is bigger than just this one incident. And I really think that universities in general are going to have to demand of these providers that their contracts be written in such a way that this kind of censorship of university programming, you know, cannot be done. That doesn't mean, by the way, that sometimes some things are done shouldn't have been done, but the universities, through its procedures of due process, should be the ones to determine that, not some private corporation outside the university.
Have you observed any patterns in colleges and universities across this nation of any that engage more frequently in censorship?
Well, I think there are all sorts of institutions. I think one of the problems we have now is that with the underfunding of public higher education and the increasing costs of private higher education, that colleges and universities increasingly are being pushed to, you know, the famous line, run themselves more like a business. Well, what do businesses do? The customer is always right. So they want to accede to popular ideas. They're afraid they'll lose funding. They're afraid if it's a public institution, they'll offend legislators. If it's private, they'll offend donors. I think that tendency has been across the board. I would like to be able, it would be interesting to say that the institutions that are financially more secure are more immune to this, but I haven't seen much evidence of that.
We have to say goodbye now, but Professor, how can our listeners get a hold of your book and learn more about you?
Oh, well, thank you for that. My book, The Future of Academic Freedom, was published by Johns Hopkins University Press just last year. In fact, just yesterday, I completed a second book on academic freedom, which they will be publishing next year. You can get it from Johns Hopkins University Press or from Amazon or other good bookstores. You can learn more about me by I write regularly for the AUP's Academe blog, which is academeblog.org. I'm not the only one who writes there. A lot of interesting things are written there. And, of course, if you're a faculty member, please join the AUP.
That's The Future of Academic Freedom, the book by Professor Henry Reichman. Thank you so much, Professor, for being a guest on Law and Disorder.
And thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.